He, during his tenure at Herald House, the president of the RLDS Church thought that Brother Russell was a communist, and one of his counselors in the RLDS first presidency suggested that he ought to be horsewhipped. He is a founder and vice chairperson of the Independence Missouri chapter of the Congress on Racial Equality Corps. Grant McMurray, the current prophet president of the RLDS Church, is well prepared for his position by virtue of having the privilege of taking 6 religion classes from Brother Russell at Graceland. And Brother Russell has been, or Bill has been widely published in the Dialogue, Sunstone, Restoration Studies, John Whitmer Historical Association, BYU Studies, and has a lot of, a wealth of information on the subject of the RLDS Church and the Community of Christ. And I introduce Bill Russell.
Thank you, Jim. you sort of stumbled briefly over RLDS and reminded me of when in Kansas City, when I was involved in the Kansas City Council on Religion and Race, which our church was not yet involved in, and I invited my stake president to their meeting, and Rabbi Bill Silverman was the chairman. And when I introduced our stake president to Rabbi Silverman, and then Rabbi Silverman turned and introduced Garland to Rabbi Bill, Rabbi Sidney Lawrence. And he said, "Sid, this is Garland Tickemeyer of the reorganized LSD Church." So, the founder of the RLDS Church was a little-known figure in Mormon history named Jason W. Briggs. 20-year-old Briggs was baptized into the church on June 8, 1841, in Potosi, Wisconsin. He was ordained an elder a year later and soon began a branch in Beloit, Wisconsin. After the martyr's death, he renounced Brigham Young and accepted James J. Strang, convinced that Strang was God's choice to succeed the fallen Mormon prophet. But Briggs became disaffected with Strang in 1850, and briefly, 1850-51, affiliated with William Smith, the prophet's brother. But he left Smith's group for the same reason he left Strang, polygamy. On November 18, 1851, Briggs had a spiritual experience which led to the creation of what they called the New Organization, which ultimately became the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and now the Community of Christ. In 1849, Briggs had publicly proclaimed Strang as the true prophet in their newspaper, but Strang would soon make 2 significant changes in his kingdom. The first resulted from his meeting Elvira Field, a young school teacher from southern Michigan, who apparently inspired Strang to embrace polygamy. I think this revelation came about the time he first embraced Elvira. Strang's strong suit had been, unlike so many of his rivals for succession, that he had previously proclaimed the ideal of monogamy. If polygamy wasn't sufficient reason for Briggs and other later reorganites to break with Strang, Strang's coronation as king on July 8, 1850 would clearly be added reason to seek another Latter-day Saint alternative. Strang was a pretty good imitator of Joseph Smith. You know, polygamy, the monarchy, digging up plates and translating them, receiving revelations, and so forth. As Briggs and others who formed the new organization searched for the right leader, they concluded that the successor to the prophet should be of the seed of Joseph, most especially his oldest son, Joseph Smith III. After young Joseph's early refusal to even talk about it, he finally accepted the leadership of the RLDS Church at the General Conference at Amboy, Illinois, on April 6, 1860. Over the next 20 years or so, the RLDS Church under Joseph III gradually discarded the major innovations of the Nauvoo period. In addition to polygamy, they rejected the doctrine of the plurality of gods, as well as baptism of the dead and the other secret temple rituals. They decided to keep a clear separation of church and state, and declined to urge all saints to gather into one central location, no doubt because of the turmoil the gathering had caused during the life of the founding prophet. Joseph III also had a revelation in 1865 approving the ordination of African Americans, setting the Prairie Mormons apart from the Mountain Mormons on race for the next 113 years. By about 1880, the RLDS Church had developed for what for the next century was a fairly stable theology, which I would call the Kirtland theology, by rejecting the Nauvoo innovations, they embraced a theology approximately the equivalent of the theology of Mormonism at the time Joseph and Sidney fled the scene in Kirtland in 1838 at midnight, I believe, with the fastest horses they could find. The early RLDS Church was a sect. Using the definitions employed by Jan Shipps in her widely acclaimed book, Mormonism, the Story of a New Religious Tradition, a sect is trying to recover a lost tradition, while a cult departs from the tradition in a radically new direction with an authority figure defining new dogmas for the group. Shipps does not use the words cult or sect in a negative fashion. She saw both the Jesus movement and the Joseph Smith movement as cults. She called us cults and we didn't mind at this time. Interestingly enough, for many years, we published a faith statement called The Epitome of Faith, which, like your Articles of Faith, was based on Joseph Smith's Wentworth letter. Thus, for many years, outsiders looked at our two faith statements and would reasonably conclude that our two churches were pretty much alike, because Joseph Smith didn't seem fit to tell John Wentworth about the more creative doctrines and practices that he had introduced in Nauvoo. Your Articles of Faith do not mention polygamy, the plurality of gods, or the secret temple rituals like baptism of the dead and the endowment. So the result is that your Articles of Faith articulate the pre-Nauvoo theology, very much like our traditional faith. So no wonder people were confused, and no wonder we got so mad when we were confused with you folks. We never wanted to be confused with Mountain Mormons, and so we rebelled at the use of the word Mormon, and we had to educate outsiders about the abominable doctrines that were being preached out west, often not realizing that they had really developed in Nauvoo. We often claim that these heresies were introduced later by the apostate Brigham Young and not by Joseph Smith, so we've had to revise our understandings of history recently. Maybe that was lying for the Lord, but I think the vast majority of our saints really did believe that Brigham and his people in Utah introduced polygamy and the plurality of gods to cite what would probably be the two most unorthodox Utah heresies. As most of you know, from the 1960s to the present, the RLDS Church has undergone a theological reconstruction wherein we have downplayed the distinctive Latter-day Saint aspects of our theological heritage and now give more emphasis to those doctrines we hold in common with our Protestant neighbors in the Midwest. W. Wallace Smith, church president from 1958 till 88, I'm sorry, till 78, 20 years, 58 to 78, called to high church offices capable men who were known for their intellect and good sense, such as Morris Draper in the first presidency, Clifford Cole, Charles Neff, Duane Cooey to the 12, and Roy Chaville as presiding patriarch. At the time he was called, in 1958, Chaville was the only member of the church with a PhD in religion, earned at the University of Chicago, where he was acquainted with Sidney Sperry. These high church officials, along with the younger professionals in certain departments at church headquarters and at Grayson College, abandoned our traditional claim to be the true church, seeing it as an unfortunate combination of ignorance and arrogance. They embraced an ecumenical spirit with regard to other Protestant churches. Many of the young professionals began to attend Protestant seminaries, most especially the University of Chicago, Union Seminary in New York, Union Theological Seminary in New York, and then, I guess most especially of all, St. Paul's School of Theology in Kansas City, which had the advantage of being a 12-minute drive from headquarters. At Graceland, professors like Robert Flanders in history and Paul Edwards in philosophy and history were among those engaged in historical and theological revisionism. In the church departments at headquarters in Independence, men like church historian Dick Howard, church statistician Jim Lancaster, and Department of Religious Education leaders Clifford Buck, Dick Lancaster, and Don Landon engaged in theological and historical revisionism. Perhaps the two publications that shocked conservative church members the most in the 60s were Jim Lancaster's 1962 article in our official publication, The Saints Herald, on the method of translation of the Book of Mormon when he introduced the seer stone and so forth, and Bob Flanders' 1965 book, Nauvoo, Kingdom on the Mississippi. In 1968, the 12 in the First Presidency decided to allow the baptism of polygamous men in non-Western cultures if they understood that our church teaches monogamy and if they promised not to marry any additional wives. Thus, we seem to be compromising our biggest reason for our initial reason for existence, opposition to polygamy. President W. Wallace Smith set a precedent by retiring in 1978 at the age of 79 and called his son, Dr. Wallace B. Smith, to succeed him, continuing the tradition of lineal succession in the office of president. Wallace had an M.D. from the University of Kansas Medical School with a specialty in ophthalmology and practiced in Independence from 1962 until 1976 when he went into the ministry. He was my ophthalmologist when I lived in Independence at the beginning of his practice. Wallace served as president designate of the church for 2 years, 1976 to 78, before then becoming president in 78 and served until his retirement in 1996. When Wallace became the president in April 1978, his father became president emeritus, a title that Wallace B. now holds that he's retired, and Grant McMurray has succeeded him as president. Wallace B. Smith served as president of the church for 18 years until 96, like I said. Early on, he revealed his preference for the revisionism that was going on in the church. 8 months into his presidency, in January 1979, the first presidency invited all full-time paid church appointee ministers and their wives to Independence, where he and his counselors read theological papers which reflected the recent liberalization in the church that Wallace was now embracing. Conservatives were very upset by the contents of these, what we call presidential papers, and they were circulated widely among conservatives to prove how far astray the church has gone. The growing division between traditionalists and the revisionists came to a head in 1984 when Wallace B. Smith announced a revelation that called for the ordination of women. The World Conference delegates voted to accept Smith's statement as revelation and added to the Doctrine and Covenants of Section 156. About 20% of the conference delegates voted against accepting Smith's statements as a revelation. That's about the percentage of negative votes you had, don't you have, for sustaining. And at least 20% of active members split from the church thereafter over the next 6 years. Wallace B. Smith was primarily responsible for 5 significant changes in the church, each of which would make the division between the traditionalist saints, who I'll call fundamentalists, and the revisionist saints, who I'll call the liberals, made it virtually impossible to repair this breach. First, and apparently the most important, was the ordination of women, called for by Section 156. This was the spark that kindled the fire that led to the major defections. Agitation for the ordination of women was clearly visible in the church throughout the 1970s and in the early 80s. Our world conferences meet every 2 years in the spring, and every conference from 1970 through 1982 had dealt, at least in part, with the issue of women's role in the church. After the approval of the revelation in 1984, then the church hierarchy announced that on November 17th, 1985, would be the first day that women would be ordained. They didn't want a kind of a rush to be the first, so we had about, I think, 85 women ordained that day around the church. The number of women ordained grew rapidly, and today I think it's probably true that in the United States and Canada, there are as many women active in the priesthood as men. Many, many pastors and other major leaders. All 3 congregations in Utah, Salt Lake, Ogden, and Orem, as well as Pocatello, have all had women as pastors. The second major change attributed to Wallace B. Smith was dedicating the new temple built in Independence as an ensign for peace. Doctrine and Covenants, Section 156, is also noted for the ordination of women, like I say, but perhaps I think the more importance in the long run was Wallace B. Smith's inclusion of these words, quote, "The temple shall be dedicated to the pursuit of peace. It shall be for reconciliation and healing of the spirit," end of quote. His father, in 1968, had called for the church to take up the task of building the temple, and now his son, Wallace B., was defining what the temple was going to be about.
What year was this?
1984 was the revelation. So both of these first 2 changes came out of that revelation, 1984, Section 156. The goal of peace, reconciliation, and healing became a central message in the church in the 1990s. While these statements might be labeled as mere slogans rather than serious theology, they do establish a standard that helps focus the church's thinking on Jesus' example of peace, love, and healing, and help shift the focus away from more narrow, self-absorbed efforts to prove to be the true church that is favored by God above all other churches. The idea that my religion is favored by God over others reminds me of the movie Head of State with Chris Rock, in which his opponent in the presidential campaign has the slogan, "God bless America and no one else." My wife and I have laughed about that many times since then. A church with a violent history in its beginnings in the 1830s and 40s was now to be transformed into a peace church. I think this is a bolder step than the ordination of women, because the ordination of women was destined to happen eventually in the earliest church, with or without a revelation from the prophet. I think there is no likelihood that we're going to go the way of the LDS Church, the Southern Baptists, or the Roman Catholics in refusing to ordain women. In my opinion, Wallace B. Smith, if he had not presented Section 156, the church would have reasonably soon embraced the ordination of women by conference action of the delegates. And if Wally's revelation in 1984 had actually gone the other way and banned the ordination of women instead of supporting it, there may well have been a reasonably similar sized defection from the church by feminists and liberals. Indeed, many had already left over the church's slow progress in this area. And so I think that is probably bigger than the ordination of women in the long run. But the symbol of the temple as an ensign for peace and the resulting work on developing a Christ-centered theology of peace has done a lot towards shifting the eyes of the saints toward what I regard as more significant matters. This has led to a refocusing of the church's mission away from an emphasis upon our unique Latter-day Saint distinctives and toward an emphasis on being disciples of Jesus Christ, trying to live out the meaning of the revelation of God in Christ in the world in which we live. As originally conceived by Joseph Smith Jr., the temple to be built in Independence was to be a place of refuge, a place where Christ would return to his people. Instead, the temple constructed in Independence looks outward as an ensign, attempting to be an ensign for peace. Okay, the third major change that I think can be credited or blamed, whichever way you look at it, on Wallace B. Smith's tenure as church president, was the adoption of the policy of open communion, adopted by vote of the delegates at the 1994 World Conference. While Wallace B. Smith and the First Presidency were supportive of open communion prior to the 1994 conference, they had decided at that time not to push the delegates for a new policy, preferring to kind of continue a dialogue in the church. And Grant, in an interview with me recently, said, "We were open to it and supportive of it, but we're not ready for another big division in the church." And so the presidency had decided not to move on it. But the delegates at the 1994 World Conference were ready for change and pressed ahead and passed a resolution supporting open communion. 1994. Mm-hmm. Open communion was a major departure from the traditional exclusivistic practice of closed communion, wherein only those baptized in the RLDS Church could participate in the Lord's Supper. But the shift from closed to open communion did not occur overnight with the passage of the 1994 conference resolution. Support for open communion had existed for some time. Ed Graceland, the editors of Courage, a journal of history, thought, and action, endorsed open communion in an editorial in September 1971 in the issue in which a young seminarian named W. Grant McMurray had an article on closed communion, a scholarly, historical article. For a number of years prior to 1994, various congregations had been quietly serving the communion to non-RLDS people. The campus congregation at Graceland College, for example, had been practicing open communion for more than a decade, well over a decade, by the time the official policy was actually changed. The campus minister just proceeded to do it quietly. In some congregations, it would be a case of non-member spouse who comes to church frequently, was seen as a part of the fellowship, and even though baptized by a minister of another denomination previously, it might be hard to pass by that person when you're serving the communion. And so I think many were quietly violating the church policy for some years. And so the resolution stated that the World Conference of 1994 has expressed its support for the principle of extending the Lord's Supper to all Christians and directed the First Presidency to develop guidelines for the administration of the sacrament. Open communion was a significant change, theologically. With the decline of the one true church belief among the saints, it made little sense to continue the old practice of closed communion. The church had come to see baptism as baptism into Christ rather than baptism into the reorganized church. Many saints had come to believe that closed communion was a barrier for outsiders who otherwise might want to participate in the fellowship of the church. While the transition from closed to open communion occurred gradually for 20 years or so, the transition on the priesthood, of course, occurred immediately on November of 1985. Okay, the fourth major change, which came under Wallace B. Smith's leadership, broke the oldest tradition in the church, the tradition of lineal descent in the office of the president. In September 1995, he designated W. Grant McMurray as his successor, subject to the will of the delegates at the April 1996 World Conference. His call of McMurray was ratified by the delegates. In the 1850s, of course, succession in the presidency was one of the two central issues in the division between the people of the new organization and those apostates that went west at Brigham Young. The other issue, of course, was the one that I think was really the most important at the time, and that was polygamy. On the issue of succession in the presidency, the LDS Church eventually settled, on a pattern of ordaining the senior member of the 12 as the new president when the outgoing president died. The new organization in the 1850s had looked for one of the sons of Joseph Smith, preferably the eldest, to accept the office. So the RLDS Church settled on the principle of lineage in church presidency, and from 1860 until 1996, one son, three grandsons, and one great-grandson of Joseph the Martyr held the office of president of the church. Many fundamentalist members who have recently split from the church and started new churches over the last two decades still expect the seed of Joseph to occupy the church presidency. And the recently organized splinter group called the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a descendant of Joseph Smith as president and prophet, Fred N. Larson, grandson of Frederick M. Smith, son of Fred M.'s daughter Lois, and also cousin of Wallace B. Smith and a cousin of Paul Edwards. History should prove McMurray to be a unique church president in the sense that he could not have reasonably sought or expected the office. Like McMurray, all of Joseph Smith's successors had been Smiths who had to wrestle with the question of whether they want to assume church leadership that's thrust on them by lineage. All of McMurray's successors will probably be people for whom the possibility of assuming the church presidency will have occurred to them. But Grant himself, not being a Smith, and at the time becoming the first non-Smith, could not have imagined that he would someday be the president of the church. In fact, he says that when he was a young lad in Independence, he couldn't have conceived of such a thing, and the thing he kind of hoped to do when he grew up was be a trash collector, because he said riding around Independence hanging off the back of a garbage truck just seemed like a cool way to spend your days. He said sometimes that profession still looks appealing, but over 30 years ago, I wrote an editorial in the little journal called Courage, in which I said that the issue isn't which method of succession, yours or ours, is the best, is the better. The issue is which is the worst. And so I think we could resume the old debates and just switch sides. So I suggest that on April 6th next year, Gordon B. Hinckley and Wallace B. Smith debate the issue, broadcast jointly on KSL in Salt Lake City and WHB in Kansas City, with Elder Hinckley arguing that seniority is the worst system imaginable because it results in 95-year-old men like himself being president, while Wallace B. Smith could argue that it's unfair to lay such heavy expectations on a young man like himself because of his birth, and it greatly narrows the body of potential persons who might provide leadership for the church. I don't know if this debate will happen or not. Let me know. I think maybe Wally would participate. The fifth major change is one that occurred after Wallace B. Smith left office, but he deserves much of the credit for it, or blame, depending on your point of view. That's the decision of the World Conference in April of 2000 to change the name of the church to Community of Christ. For many years, there have been a noticeable body of saints who wanted a new name for the church. It was long and so forth. The old name did not fit the newly evolving mission of the church. For example, there's little expectation among church members that we're living in the last days, and Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints clearly confused us with the Mormons, and reorganized didn't seem meaningful at all. So the community of Christ idea surfaced at a retreat that the top leaders of the church held in Estes Park, Colorado, in September 1994. The First Presidency, the 12, and the Bishopric were there and working on a new mission statement for the church. At that retreat, the council came up with a new mission statement, which reads very simply, "We proclaim Jesus Christ and promote communities of joy, hope, love, and peace." Some participants at the retreat recall Wallace B. Smith as the one who first suggested the new name, Community of Christ. Grant McMurray said in his interview with me, quote, "I'm not sure if Wally was the first one to suggest it, but he did suggest the name Community of Christ at some point. We decided to float it and see the reaction," end of quote. The leadership supported the name change, but waited nearly six years until the conference of 2000, when it finally seemed sure that the new name would be approved by a significant majority of the delegates, and Grant ruled it would take a two-thirds majority to pass. And so perhaps the most important speech in the swaying undecided delegates was that of President Emeritus Wallace B. Smith, who lives in Independence, Missouri, but was a delegate representing the Dominican Republic. When Wally rose to speak in favor of the proposal, his words included the following, quote, "I remember with joy the meeting of the Joint Council at Estes Park. The unity of feeling we experienced at that time regarding the name Community of Christ was truly inspiring. I personally feel that this name represents quite clearly what we are seeking to become, perhaps not having fully achieved, but seeking to become today and in the future, while at the same time preserving our heritage, rooted as it is in a strong sense of community and grounded in Jesus Christ," end of quote. The resolution received a 78% favorable vote, and the new name would not take effect before the next year, January of 2001, the exact time to be determined by the First Presidency. I presume they just pulled a date out of the hat because they chose April 6th, 2001 is the date that they changed the name of the church. When the new name was approved at the conference, the RLDS Church had changed a great deal under two presidents named Wallace Smith from 1958 to 1996. The father had not pushed for these changes, but he had appointed intelligent men who did. The son, Wallace B., embraced many of the revisionist ideas, and under his leadership, some of these became church policy. The name change at the 2000 conference can be seen as the culmination of a 40-year theological struggle in which the RLDS Church broke loose from its 19th-century sectarian worldview and tried to reshape its faith to be more Christian and more relevant to a changing, highly educated society. The 19th-century worldview was hard to shake, though, because much of it's canonized in Latter-day Scriptures. The RLDS Church has entered mainstream Protestantism of the type that's associated with the National Council of Churches, with its liberal policies on Christian social concerns and ecumenical cooperation. Indeed, in 2002, the conference went on record in favor of proceeding to investigate officially joining the National Council of Churches and World Council, although no action has been taken as yet, but it's being considered. During the discussion on changing the name of the church, one delegate from Dallas, Andrew Shelton, strongly expressed his opposition to changing the name of the church because he said, quote, "We don't deserve the name Community of Christ. I do not believe that we can accurately describe ourselves as a true community of Christ dedicated to the pursuit of peace, justice, reconciliation, and healing of the Spirit until we resolve at least two moral issues of profound theological importance." End of quote. The two issues he cited were, number one, the failure of the church so far to end the requirement of rebaptism for those who are baptized in another Christian denomination, and two, the failure to grant equal rights to homosexual members. Shelton concluded, "I cannot support a name which describes us as something we are not. Until we make these changes, we are nothing more than a small church that sounds Mormon. We are not truly a community of Christ." So while the RLDS Church, or now the Community of Christ, still retains some sign of the, maybe a lot of signs, of the authoritarian cult with a man at the head who speaks for God and decides policy by himself, the Church has made significant strides toward affirming the centrality of Christ's message of peace, love, and healing, rather than the centrality of Latter-day Prophets. The new name reflects that change. It appears that the issues of being a peace church of open communion, having a non-Smith as prophet, as well as the name change, did not bring significant defections from the church, probably because most of the conservatives already left over the ordination of women. To those who worry that, you know, we are losing our uniqueness, the reply of many revisionist saints is that the church is merely seeking to be a community of Christ. What could be a more difficult challenge, they ask, than to seek to be a community of peace, love, and healing in a culture saturated with materialism, violence, and sexual exploitation? What could be more difficult than to learn to love people unconditionally without regard to their worthiness or their beliefs? What better goal could we possibly strive to achieve, they ask? Is there anything else that really matters for a Christian church? The church may never satisfy young idealists like Andrew Shelton that is truly a community of Christ, but hopefully the church will try to meet the high standards of its idealistic youth. Thank you.
I remember when the name change was announced, and it was in the one of our newspapers. I'm from the East, so news travels strangely out there. But and it had an article in there interviewing someone from the Community of Christ, and they said, well, there's two reasons why we made this change. One was because the name of the church was hard to translate, and the other was because they were confusing them with us. And I just made a quip to somebody, wouldn't it be funny if we changed our name to the Reorganized Community of Christ? Anyways.
We'd accept that. Let's take care of that thing.
Anyways, we'd like to invite any questions you might have, and we'd invite you to come up to the podium so that you could, maybe we could do it like testimony meeting if you want to take places up in the front row and state your question. We just do ask that you don't do a dissertation, but you know, keep your questions short so that Bill can have time to answer.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed that. Three quick questions. I wonder if you'd expand a little bit on the question of why W. Wallace brought men and women whom he must have known something regarding their philosophical inclinations. And did Wallace B. grow up in a home surrounded by that influence, not just from those other leaders, but from his own father? Number two, this is a hard one. I've heard that in discussions among themselves, Community of Christ demographers, church historians, so forth, suggest that the loss to the church after 1984 in terms of its strongest members, as reflected in things like tithe paying, has been almost disastrous, and that the construction of the temple, which was hoped would really turn that around, has not had that effect. And finally, what is the first instance where the conference directed the first presidency to do something that was quite significant, where the first presidency had not taken the initiative?
Okay, yeah. I jotted a little bit down because if they ask more than one question, I've usually forgot the first one. The second one, I have to answer the first one. I think the way, as far as the Smith family, I think I would, the general way I'd respond is I think all of the Smiths, you know, from Joseph Jr. down through Wally B., they've always valued education. I think there's always been that tension within the church between those who feel like education is really important, and of course, Fred M. Smith, who was president way back in 1915, had a Ph.D., and Israel Smith was a lawyer. The first Wallace had a B.A. degree. He was a businessman, but a B.A. degree, which for his day puts him, you know, a little bit in the church anyway, puts him a cut above most people. And then W. Wallace, I'm sorry, Wallace B., the ophthalmologist, the medical doctor. So I think W. Wallace Smith, first of all, he came in relatively inexperienced in the church. I mean, he'd been an elder for a long time, hadn't been active for some during some of his early adult years, and only became really active for a few years before he became an apostle. And then he was only an apostle for 3 years, and he went in the presidency. Now he's in the presidency for 8 years, so he had about 10 or 12 years of experience. But that's still, he's outranked in experience in church by a lot of other people. So I think probably part of it was he looked to really highly respected people like Frank Edwards, Paul's father, who he kept on in the presidency, who was really a bright, very, very bright person. And then of the others and the apostles, I think Draper was the guy who really stood out as a strong intellect in the apostles, and then the guys in the 12. And then Roy Chaville, the PhD who's in religion, who was teaching at Graceland, W. Wallace passed over Lynn Smith, who was a direct descendant of Joseph Smith, and Lynn expected to be the new presiding patriarch by lineage, and Wallace just brushed that aside and brought in Dr. Roy Chaville. So I just think he had a great respect for education and certainly felt that guys like Draper and Edwards in the presidency would be very valuable assistance to him, as he maybe got himself a little bit more rooted in the church presidency. Membership decline, that's certainly in the domestic field, in the United States and Canada, certainly there's been a membership decline. Part of it being, you know, that the liberal churches are generally not doing very well in America anyway, which I explain as people love to have certainty, and we don't offer certainty. We offer questions and not answers, but, you know, more questions than answers. And it's hard to say whether or not the temple has helped revive the membership or anything like that. I think the temple, certainly, there are many of us in the church, I think, who really look forward to meetings in the temple because they're often very, very spiritually uplifting and so forth. I think it's too early to tell whether the temple is achieving its purpose of helping us become a peace church or peace of healing and reconciliation. Certainly, a lot of what goes on in the temple is focused to that. I mean, I go to church in Lamona, Iowa. Now, that's a college town. And I go down to lots of things in Independence, so I don't have maybe a representative sampling, but, you know, for a lot of people, you almost never hear about Joseph Smith in church anymore, but you hear about peace and reconciliation, healing of spirit, and so forth. And so, to me, that's done a lot to redirect the church. Whether or not the numbers in the United States and Canada will kind of make an upswing, I don't know. And then I think Ron Roeming might be able to ask and add to this, but I'm pretty sure that over the years there have been a number of times when the conference has, well, I know that's been true, but I don't know if it's how frequent, but it's not uncommon for the conference to direct the first presidency to do something. My own experience in 2000 might illustrate it. We didn't end up directing the first presidency, but we thought about it. A guy named Roy Schaefer wrote a resolution for conference opposing the death penalty. Wanted the church to take a position against the death penalty. He got me to introduce it in Lamona, but the resolution directed the first presidency to provide materials on the death penalty to help the members. Well, I decided 2/3 of the American people in favor of the death penalty. I would just like to see this passed, even if it's just by 51%. So I took out the part that called for the presidency to provide materials and so forth, just because I was afraid that would derail the thing. Maybe I shouldn't have taken it out because it passed by a 2/3 majority, which shocked and delighted me. But at any rate, that's pretty common, to have a resolution directing the presidency to do something. Our conferences do that. Yeah, Eugene. Why don't you come on up, Gene, and get on the mic, and then others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the LDS Church is directing the prophet a lot. No, I don't know.
No, I'm not.
Uh-huh, okay.
Is it a possibility? No.
Yeah, I was pretty sure the answer. Gene.
Bill, I had the privilege of getting to know some of your top leaders several years ago, mm-hmm. And I have a special request to know what happened to my favorite, Jeff Spencer.
Oh.
And why, where has he gone and why, mm-hmm. and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Okay. Jeff was an apostle for 10 years or so. became an apostle. He became an apostle in 1984 in that same Revelation, section 156, that called for women. And some people said that's a reason, that's a sign of the apostasy of that revelation, because any revelation of the name Jeff Spencer has to be an apostate or whatever. Jeff was known as a very liberal leader in the church. Finally went into the 12 in 1984, served 10 or 12 years in the 12, and then retired. His health is not good lately. When I see him, it appears that he's slowed down an awful lot. Whoops. What's that? Became the president of the Quorum of 12, yes. Retired about 4 years later, so he had a fairly short tenure as president of the Quorum of 12. I interviewed him for my book on the schism in the church about 2 years ago, and I've seen him since then, but he's just slowed down a lot, but still lives in Independence and still a delightful guy. He's been pastor of his congregation since he retired from the 12. He's very pastoral, very good pastoral leader. Mm-hmm. Yeah, come on up. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, these two first, and just get in line. You'll be third. I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were here for. I should have noticed it.
Just three quick questions. With what percentage of your membership did you lose? Say around 1984.
About 25%. Of the active members.
That's okay. Uh-huh. And what was the loss in the 1920s over the Supreme Directional Controversy?
I don't really know that, and I don't think that's particularly very well. I think it's less. I think I looked at Ron because he's an archivist and probably knows a lot of things. I don't know. I think it was less than that, but it was significant in the 1920s.
Okay, and finally, since I live just a few miles from Estes Park, where was this big conference held?
I don't know. Someplace in Estes Park, but I don't know.
I got five of your changes, but not the sixth, apparently. Ordination of women?
Well, I only had five.
I only had five. Yeah. That answers the question.
Yeah. The hot issue right now, of course, is what to do about pre-ordination of homosexuals. But that's one close communion. The presidency is asking the church to continue in dialogue and is organizing listening circles for people to listen to both sides and try to come to some kind of consensus. But that would be number six 10 years from now, maybe. I don't know. Yes, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Get pen ready?
Okay.
For the
Yeah, you got more than one question. Just cancer easy, so I...
Yeah, and the first one, not to be disrespectful, but that temple in Independence is the only piece of scary architecture I have ever seen. And I just wondered if there's any... If you guys ever talk about that. Seeing it from a distance, I had no idea what it was, and it inspired fear, not awe. And I kind of know what the party line is from reading. It didn't represent what it was, what evidently the architect intended. And if you could explain to me how you talked about voting on Revelation, and clarify on what basis, I think it's the quorum that votes, not the membership at large?
All the $3,000.
Delegates. Okay, and what basis they're encouraged, if it's that they agree with it, if that they see the wisdom in it, or they're supposed to go home and take 3 days of prayer and fasting and then come back and vote. So anyway, if you'd speak on that. And if you think the idea of a woman prophet in the community of Christ, would it be likely to happen sooner than later, perhaps because you're moving in a progressive way, or would they be a residual reluctance because males had the priesthood? And then early on you talked about, just kind of in passing, about separation of church and state. And so I got the idea that there was something you're uncomfortable with how... I guess as a Mormon, I think, we believe in, partly maybe because I don't live in Utah, but I believe in separation of church and state. So I wondered if there were some particular things that you guys saw that you really didn't like and made you want to go a different direction.
Okay. So now in the future, four questions is the maximum. I don't know about the scary architecture in the temple, but for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a spire upward. See, we're heading up to heaven.
Did
we there at night? No, I don't know. So it's a spiral, big spiral upward. Now, maybe the real reason for it is, how Roman Catholic kids, when they play basketball, they step the free throw line and they cross themselves and shoot. Well, our RLDS, a Community of Christ kids, can get the ball from the referee and go and shoot, and that ought to give make a lot better percentage. I'm really not very confident in commenting on the architecture. I like it.
And I had the chance last year after the JWH convention to play it for many, many hours. I think the acoustics, the musical acoustics in the Community of Christ Temple are, for me, the best of any building I have ever been in. Mm-hmm. And here's what I think makes the difference. If you get in the balcony, you know, you're maybe 100 or 200 feet away from the choir and the organ pipes, but you have the immediacy of sound. But you also have the glorious sheen of reverberation because of that big mm-hmm. spire that goes up in the center.
Yeah.
I think that acoustically it's a marvel.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And to me, it's the interior that I like, and I don't pay much attention to the exterior, I suppose. You talk about, delegates. How are the delegates supposed to determine whether to vote? Actually, that's the title of my paper on Saturday, although I'm not sure I answered the question there either. But I'd say that we do, because we don't do much about saying, okay, delegates, what happens is, like this conference, I think it was Tuesday morning, it was announced that Grant McMurray has a revelation to consider. We break into quorum sessions, you know, the 12, the bishops, the high priests, the elders, the Aaronic priesthood, bishops, 70s, and so forth. And then each quorum session considers it, and then they report back to the full conference, and then there's discussion of the full conference. And this year, since homosexuality is a big issue, there were conservatives among the delegates who thought Grant is trying to get us ready for ordination of homosexuals, and so they would speak opposed. They got up and spoke opposed to the revelation. But I would say the normal expectation would be a person should, you know, read it, pray about it, study it, you know, compare it to what they think is right and moral and so forth and so forth. And so it's really our personal judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going to do that in the morning.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about prophets and prophecies. But the question is the debate is whether it is the will of the Lord.
Yeah.
Well,
see, it's a check on a prophet presenting something that the conference thinks isn't. Like 20% thought the women's ordination thing was just contrary to Scripture. Some voted no. I have respect for those who voted no, even though I'd been favoring it for 20 years or so before that. And the third one was a woman prophet. Will it kind of become sooner than might otherwise because will we have kind of a desire to have a woman as soon as possible, or maybe we'll be more conservative because I don't know. That's really in the hands of Grant McMurray, because now our tradition is, well, it's tradition goes all the way back, but no longer it's lineage. It used to be lineage, and it's the prophet's call, who the next prophet is. Well, if Grant McMurray is in a big hurry, then he's probably preparing a woman now. If he's not in any kind of big hurry and wants to let it go, run its natural course, then he's not worrying about it, I suppose. Separation of church and state, I think just, you know, Nauvoo. One thing Grant said at the last World Conference, he says Joseph Smith was, you know, a mayor, prophet of the church and mayor of the town and commander of the militia and king of the kingdom. I'm not sure if you mentioned that or not. But then he says, I'm sure glad that job description has changed. So the RLDS Church, you know, really, from the beginning, Joseph Smith III, maybe just sensed that, look at the trouble my daddy got in over this. So we've just had a stronger sense of the need to separate church and state. And I think Utah, at least in your earlier years, pretty much a theocracy. So
I can ask five questions.
One question.
Uh-huh.
What is the official position of the Community of Christ with regard to the authenticity of the Book of Mormon?
Mm-hmm. Don't really have one. I mean, yes and no. Yes and no. Well, I'm sorry. What is the official position of the RLDS Church on the Book of Mormon? World Conference Resolution 215 in 1878 affirmed the three standard books as the standard of authority for the church. That still stands. And certainly, still officially, the Book of Mormon is part of our standard, part of our scripture. Therefore, it's authentic in that sense, as we see it as scripture. However, if the question really was, what's the official position as to whether or not it's historical or not, which is a quite different question as I see it. If it's just a question of whether it's historical, we don't have one. Grant McMurray, when he was on Martin Tanner's religion talk show in June of 1996, somebody called in and said, do you believe that the Book of Mormon is history? And Grant responded, history just doesn't provide us the tools to make a definitive answer on that question. Somebody else thought maybe he was just answering for the church and not him personally. So somebody called in and said, do you, Grant McMurray, believe the Book of Mormon is his history? And he gave the same answer. History just doesn't give us the tools to make a certain question on that. So yeah, it's part of our standard of scripture. I would guess the vast majority, the top leaders, at least in the presidency and the 12 and other major, the vast majority do not think it's history, but still think it's legitimately part of the scripture. It's the founding document of our church. That's what started the whole thing. Others? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you come and sit there. Yeah. I should be watching the first row closer.
My question is in regard to the history and involvement of the Temple Endowment. From my understanding, a big root of the Temple Endowment started with Joseph Smith and Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. And earlier you spoke about the original separation from the LDS Church involving Brigham Young's version of the endowment. Mm-hmm. But what about, how does the Community of Christ feel about Joseph Smith's version of the endowment when he was alive?
Most of us don't know anything about it and don't care. I mean, there's not a... It's not an issue. I didn't mean to be flippant, but many of us are very ignorant of it. And I only have kind of a vague ideas of what the endowment is. Of course, now you all are not supposed to talk to us about it anyway, are you? The secret stuff. So I've commented that before. I've been involved in the Mormon History Association for 33 years, Sunstone for 20 years, and I still don't know very much about what goes on when you go in those tall white buildings out there. But no, it's not an issue. I'm sure. See, when Wallace, W. Wallace, his revelation 68, said, let's get on with building an Independence Temple. Paul Edwards, who some of you know, went down to Independence, talked to President Duane Cooey, a counselor in the presidency, said, we're not going to be doing that Mormon stuff, are we? You know, baptizing for the dead and stuff. And Duane said, no, don't worry about it, Paul. We're not going to be doing that sort of stuff. No, I don't think there's any concept of an endowment associated with our temple. I mean, I'm sure there never will be. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yeah, John. Okay.
Given your emphasis on peace in the church now, what does your church feel about the war in Iraq?
Given our emphasis on peace, what do we feel about the war in Iraq? Don't believe there's been any statement. I will say that the first Iraq war in 1991 was the Standing High Council of the church that often issues... often discusses moral issues and so on. They issued a statement against the first Iraq war. I don't think they've made a statement on the second Iraq war. I'm quite confident they did. It'd be opposed to it. I think the vast majority of our top leaders think this war is terrible. And I think that's a fair statement to make of the top leaders. Yeah.
Add an addendum. The discussion they had about, how LDS... basically prophecy says I've had a revelation, we vote on it, and that's it. But I do know there's some more behind-the-scene things that go on. When I was a missionary, L. Tom Perry came down to talk to us, and it was right after they had added the two revelations to then the Pearl of Great Price. There became Section 137 and 138. And he said Bruce R. McConkie came into the Council of the Twelve room and recommended that these be added to the scriptures.
That's a Joseph F. Smith statement.
Yeah, Smith on the vision of the celestial kingdom, and then the one on the redemption of the dead. And then they brought the idea to the first presidency, and President Kimball said, well, let me take it under advisement. Uh-huh. And he went through and he came back to the 12 and he says, I want you to go through both these documents and make sure they don't contradict anything we already have. Uh-huh. So each of the 12 had to go through that, and then it became part of the Pearl of Great Price, and someone asked President Kimball, why'd you put it in the Pearl of Great Price? And he said, I don't know. And then they put in the...
I just assumed it was the Doctrine and Covenants.
It's it went into the Doctrine and Covenants. Second thing that happens is, take, for example, the document on the Proclamation of the Family. They just didn't sit down and have a revelation and did that. They go through, and they have people in the history department that cull through any document related to the topic. And I'm sure that even when President Kimball was pondering about the priesthood revelation, he probably had a pile that thick that he went through and went through all the previous statements, journal entries of church leaders. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we talk about prayer and fasting, but we leave out the part about pondering. And that's a big part of it. Jan?
I was going to say that it's almost like the second half of this. The session in the morning on prophecy in the morning tradition is going to carry this conversation forward.
Mm-hmm.
And mine on Saturday be the third half of it.
But the thing that is left out with the LDS part of it is that it doesn't go to the people for a say before it's put out there. It just, once they've made the decision. But I just will say on their behalf that it's just not a flimsy decision. There's a lot behind it. And I just wanted to let you know, I stopped up the church distribution during the lunchtime, and the teachings of the president of the church is David O. McKay. Uh-huh. We were having a discussion about that. I was going to say teachings, Wallace B. Smith, but no, it's David O. McKay. That's the one for next year. Now, we do have a couple more minutes. Is there any more questions? Keep it down to one, maybe. Any other thoughts? Okay.
Is there any dialogue going on between your church and ours, if I can represent the Mormon church? Mm-hmm. I really enjoy your comments, and I wish there were more of that. That's why I'm holding the question.
Yeah. I think, first of all, I guess, over the years, the Smith family have had conversations and contact, and Dan, what's his name, Buddy Youngman used to have these Smith family reunions. But way back, I mean, because you got Joseph Smith III is a cousin of Joseph S. Smith, I guess it would be. But anyway, the leaders of their churches have been cousins for a long time. And so there's been, through the Smith family, there's been a decent amount of contact. I think, though, the biggest in the last 35 years or so is the Mormon History Association, where, you know, some very, very prominent historians and leaders in both churches have been, got to know each other on a personal basis. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang in Independence about 10 years ago. So there's some contact between the top leaders. Orrin Hatch, I got to have lunch with Orrin Hatch in Grayson when he's running for president and doing the Iowa caucuses. And he has met virtually all the RLDS, Wallace Smith, I'm not sure about Grant McMurray, has contact with, had a number of RLDS people. And Wallace B. Smith has had contact with a decent amount. So there's conversations going on. It's not as much as it ought to be, I would hope, but certainly it's just there. Mm-hmm. Ron?
When the Mormon Tabernacle Choir came to town, Reverend Hinckley also came.
That's right, Gordon B. Hinckley was there.
He visited President Smith in his office in the business of time, and President Smith had moved his office in the
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Hinckley was one of the first official visitors.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So just for the record, for the tape, Gordon B. Hinckley came with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and I believe had dinner with President Wallace B. Smith, was one of Wallace B. Smith's first visitors in his new office because the temple had just been opened very recently. I know Ezra Taft Benson was at the Kirtland Temple a few years before that. And so anyway, there's a minimum amount, but some reasonably good discussion going on. So. Well, I think we're ready to quit then, aren't we? Okay, we'll quit then. Thank you.